Brother Joel Migas from Chicago is our next speaker. His topic will be The Beast of Revelation 13.
Thank you, Brother Tim and Brother Randy. Well, brethren, it's a privilege and a blessing for Sister Kathy and I to be with you here in convention. If it hasn't already been delivered, we bring with us the love of your brethren in Chicago. Our subject is the beasts of Revelation 13, and a few years ago I came across a treatise written by Brother Chester Sunbaum entitled The Beast and His Image, written in 1948. Now, Brother Sunbaum was one of the intellectual giants of the Bible student movement in the mid-20th century, and in this paper he analyzed the beasts of Revelation 13 and drew comparisons between them and the beasts of Daniel chapter 7, and Revelation chapter 17. Today we'll examine Revelation chapter 13 verse by verse with our interpretation taken largely from Brother Sunbaum's paper, which is available online at this website, portlandbible.com, and we'll also be taking our interpretation from the writings of Brother Russell. As a quick overview, Verses 1 to 10 of Revelation 13 trace the development of the Catholic church-state system pictured by a leopard-like beast from the beginning of the Gospel Age to the year 1799. Verses 11 to 13 describe the establishment of the church-state system of England, pictured by a two-horned beast from its beginning in the 1530s during the reign of King Henry VIII. And verses 14 to 18 of Revelation 13 describe the formation of the Protestant Federation, pictured as an image of the first beast, the leopard-like beast, beginning in the year 1846 with the creation of the Evangelical Alliance. Now let's begin with part one of Revelation 13 by reading verses 1 and 2. And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, and his seat, and great authority. The beast like unto a leopard rose up out of the sea, or restless masses of peoples. Now, history tells us that shortly after our Lord's first advent, in the beginning of the Gospel Age, the Roman Empire began to weaken under attack by its enemies, particularly hordes of barbarians from the north. The once mighty and unified Roman Empire divided at first into two, the Western Empire and the Eastern Empire. Then the Western Empire divided again and again into eventually 10 ruling houses. Now, history dates the fall of the Roman Empire at A.D. 476, but the crumbling began, really, two or three centuries earlier. And this was a time of unrest and instability among the people, like the waters of a troubled sea, as they anxiously watched the empire collapse and yearned for stability in their changing world. So they turned to the only thing that was stable in their world, their church. Now in verse 2 it says, a dragon gave to this beast his power and seat and great authority. What does that mean? In Revelation, a dragon, a very specific beast, symbolizes a civil or non-religious power. And so in this case, the Roman Empire under the rulership of the Caesars is what this dragon pictures. To whom did the Caesars give their power and when? Well, in 539 A.D., when the emperor, then Justinian, sent his army from Constantinople, the capital of the Eastern Empire, to Rome in order to drive the barbarian Ostrogoths away from the Western region and solidify the Pope's temporal power in Europe. 539 A.D. thus marks the date when the papal system took control of the remnants of the Western Roman Empire, and the dragon, the civil power of Eastern Rome under the Caesars, gave to the leopard-like beast, the ecclesiastical power of the Catholic Church of Rome under the popes, his seat, his power, and great authority. Pictured here in this illustration, as you see the right hand of the beast, his power and authority, like a flash of lightning going into the leopard-like beast. And so thus the Roman Empire changed from pagan Rome under the Caesars to papal Rome under the popes, from civil Rome to ecclesiastical Rome, a church-state system. Let's continue reading with verse 3. And I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. Verses 1 and 2 were a brief history of the beginning of the Gospel Age to the year 539 AD. But now verse 3 jumps forward in time to the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s to give us one more identifying event so that there is no doubt as to what this leopard-like beast represents. Again, history tells us that beginning in 1517, with the work of Martin Luther, the sword of the Spirit of Truth was used to bring to light old truths such as justification by faith, which had been hidden for centuries in the false doctrine of the Mass. In Volume 3, pages 109 to 112, Brother Russell traces the promise and then the disappointment of this turn of historic events. I'll quote a part of it. Luther, the leading spirit of the Reformation, did not stop with one error, but attempted to throw out many others and nailed upon the church door at Wittenberg, October 31st, 1517, 95 theses, all of which were objections to the doctrines of papacy. But alas, the cleansing work so nobly and courageously commenced was too radical to be popular, and the friends and admirers of Luther and his associates conquered in a measure, overpowering them with policy, prudence, flatteries, and promises of help and success, provided their course were shaped according to the dictates of the wisdom of this world. Several of the German princes became ardent admirers of the bold reformers. These princes aided the reformers, and in return for the aid, they received from the reformers recognition of their kingly rights. Thus, the same kind of union between church and state, which had worked such injury to the truth before in papacy, was the snare by which the adversary impeded and obstructed the cleansing of the sanctuary so nobly begun. Reformation and cleansing for a time ceased, and instead of progressing with the cleansing, the reformers gave attention to organizing themselves and to revamping and repolishing many of the old papal dogmas at first so loudly condemned. Thus did Satan decoy the reformers into the very harlotry, union of church and state, which they had denounced in the Church of Rome. And thus the deadly wound which papacy had received was for a time healed. So Revelation 13, 1 to 3 gives us major events in the history of the rise of papal Rome. Now verses 4 to 8 take a broad look at the nature and character of this counterfeit church-state system. And they worshiped the dragon which gave power unto the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain before the foundation of the world. Verse 4 describes the power of the Holy Roman Empire in its heyday. And verses 5 to 7 foretell a persecution of the true saints of God for 42 months. How long is 42 months? Well, 42 months times 30 days per prophetic month gives us 1,260 days. The exact same period as the time, times, and half a time of papal supremacy in Daniel 7:25, that is, 539 to 1799 A.D., during which time the true saints of God were indeed persecuted. I don't have time to go into it, but the correlation between the fourth beast of Daniel 7 and the beasts of Revelation 13 is so striking that if we understand Daniel, we can then understand Revelation. While Revelation 13 gives us this dismal foretelling, which indeed come true, it also tells us that despite all the persecutions, in the end, the church class would be triumphant and the oppressor would be overthrown. Listen to Revelation 13, 9 and 10. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. So with these few words in Revelation 13, 1 to 10, the history of the counterfeit church-state system led by Papal Rome is portrayed in symbol from its beginnings in the 1st and 2nd century through its persecution of the saints in the Dark Ages to the breaking of its power in 1799 at the end of the 42 months. That brings us to the second main division of Revelation 13, a portrayal of the rise of the church-state system of England, in verses 11 to 13. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon, and he exercised all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. So how do you suppose we can conclude that this two-horned beast, described in only these three verses and rather symbolically, is the church-state system of England? Well, secular history speaks loudly and clearly to answer this question. The history of the church-state system of England begins during the reign of King Henry VIII, who became the ruler at age 18 in the year 1509. Now, Henry famously had six wives, the first of whom was Catherine of Aragon, a devout Catholic from Spain's royal house, whom he married the same year he became king. Now, initially, Henry was a firm Catholic, as all of England was in 1509. There were no Protestants yet, only Catholics. In fact, a few years later, Henry regarded Luther, when he began his teachings, as a heretic and even wrote a book against heretics, entitled The Seven Sacraments, in the year 1518. And for that service, the Pope bestowed upon Henry the title Defender of the Faith, which English monarchs still carry to this day. Now, all kings greatly desired a son to succeed them as king. Indeed, two sons, an heir and a spare, was the minimum expected of royal wives to produce. But alas, Henry's first wife, Catherine, bore him five children, of whom four died young, and the sole survivor was a daughter named Mary, born in 1516. So without a son from his first wife, around 1529, Henry asked the Pope for a divorce so he could marry Anne Boleyn, a lady of the court who had caught his eye. The Pope refused Henry's rather audacious request, whereupon Henry decided to take matters into his own hands. In 1532, he fired the Catholic Cardinal Wolsey, the Pope's right-hand man in England, who had also opposed a divorce for Henry, and replaced him with Thomas Cranmer as the Archbishop of Canterbury. In 1533, Henry secretly married Anne Boleyn with the Archbishop's approval, who bore him a daughter, Elizabeth, later that same year. Soon after, Archbishop Cranmer declared Henry's first marriage to Catherine null and void so that he could be legally married to his second wife, Anne Boleyn. In 1534, Henry had Parliament pass a law called the Act of Supremacy, which decreed that the king was the supreme head of the church in England. Now, even at this date, Henry still regarded himself as a good Catholic. In fact, he died that way. There was no Reformation at work in England as it was in other countries at this time. Henry was merely establishing his authority over the Catholic Church hierarchy in England. Indeed, to promote this even further, Henry had Parliament pass another law, the Law of Treason and Heresy, which stated that to hold any doctrines other than those of the Catholic Church was heresy. And, here's the important part, to refuse to acknowledge the king as the head of the church in England was treason. The Pope was no longer in charge of the Catholic Church, at least not in England. It was the king. Then, in a stroke of political genius, Henry confiscated all the churches, lands, and buildings owned by the Pope and gave them to his friends and to the nobles in his own country. Now, Henry was unwilling to give Anne a second chance to bear him a son. One strike and you're out now in having Henry's children. So the marriage predictably turned sour, and in 1536, Henry had Anne executed on a trumped-up charge of unfaithfulness. Henry married his third wife, Jane Seymour that same year, and she at last gave Henry, the long-awaited heir, a son named Edward. Tragically, Jane Seymour died shortly after giving birth to Henry's long-awaited son. Now, this family history may have seemed a little bit tedious and boring, but it is important because it illuminates the origins of the Church of England. When Henry VIII died in 1547, England was still a Catholic country. Although Luther's reformist teachings had gained some followers in the capital city of London and also in the southeastern part of the country, which lay closest to the continent of Europe. When Henry died, his only son Edward became King Edward VI at age 9. Now, Edward was young, so his uncle, the Duke of Somerset, who favored the Reformation more for its political advantage than for its doctrinal efficiency, effectively ran the country. Under Edward's reign, England separated itself from the Pope's authority, and the Church of England, which also is called by the name Episcopal Church, developed its own hierarchy, ceremonies, and in a few instances, doctrines. But it remained in many ways very much like the Catholic Church. Now, you might think the story of the rise of the Church of England ends here with the Episcopal Church well established, and we can now get back to Revelation 13, but wait, it gets much more involved, and this is important to our understanding of that chapter. Edward died of tuberculosis at age 16 after a short reign of 7 years and without a child to succeed him. The next ruler of England would be either his older half-sister Mary or his other older half-sister Elizabeth, but which one? In a series of political machinations too detailed to go into here, Mary won out over her rival for the crown, Elizabeth, and had her imprisoned. Queen Mary I, the daughter of the spurned Catherine, a staunch Catholic, exacted her mother's revenge upon the country by undoing all the laws passed under Henry VIII and his son Edward. Mary turned the clock backward, and England was once again Roman Catholic. But Mary didn't stop there. She had almost 300 people who had supported the separation from Rome burned at the stake as heretics, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had declared her mother's marriage to Henry null and void. For these atrocities, she earned the nickname Bloody Mary. Thankfully, Mary died after only 5 years as queen and was succeeded by her sister, Elizabeth I, who undid everything Mary did and restored the Church of England to its separate status from the Church of Rome once again and for good. History is kind to Elizabeth. It tells us that she ruled firmly, sometimes even severely, but wisely for 45 years, guiding her country and her people through the difficult transition from Catholicism to Episcopalianism. She never married, realizing that if she married a Catholic man, it would alienate her Protestant subjects. And if she married a Protestant man, it would alienate her Catholic subjects. Elizabeth died in 1603 and was succeeded by her cousin, King James I. Yes, that King James, who was well appreciated by us Bible students, except perhaps by those of you who prefer to read a different translation. Now let's go back and look at those facts of history that I just reviewed with you and see how they fulfill the details of the prophecy of Revelation 13, 11 to 13. As we take a look back on the rise of the church in England, it's important to note that the Reformation in England was the work of the government of kings and queens and those vying for power and political interests, rather than a people's struggle for religious purity as it was in other countries. Thus, in this fulfillment of Revelation 13:11, which says that the two-horned beast came up out of the earth. By contrast, the first beast, the leopard-like beast, came out of, do you remember? The sea. The sea, as we said before, represented the unstable masses of society who desired stability and so turned to their church. By contrast, the wealthier classes represented by the earth were the source of the origin of the Church of England. Not an outcry of the common people, but from the desires and machinations of the king himself and from his friends and the nobles who acquired the land and the wealth formerly owned by the Pope. Verse 11 goes on to say this beast had two horns, representing the two countries Henry VIII ruled, England and Ireland. Indeed, this new church was called the Church of England and Ireland for 333 years, from 1538 to 1871. And the horns were horns like a lamb, picturing that England at this time was not yet a dominating, imperious, warlike nation, which it did become. But it was at this time when this prophecy was fulfilled, at relative peace with its neighbors. Lastly, verse 11 tells us that this two-horned beast spoke as a dragon. Do you remember what we said a dragon represents? Civil power. And the voice of the Church of England was the voice of the King of England, the civil ruler. Verse 12 of Revelation 13 gives us more prophetic symbology that our history lesson explains. Verse 12 says that the two-horned beast exercised the power of the first beast and caused the earth and the people to worship the first beast whose deadly wound had been healed. What a perfect description this is of the Church of England in the 1530s. Martin Luther's Reformation, beginning in 1517, was the deadly wound upon the first beast of papal system. It was Henry VIII's law of treason and heresy, which declared it to be heresy to hold any doctrine other than those of the Catholic Church. Thus did the Church of England, the two-horned beast, cause the people to worship the first beast, the Catholic Church. And verse 13 gives us more. It says, the two-horned beast did great wonders. It made fire come down out of heaven in the sight of men. Now, when we think of fire coming down out of heaven in the sight of men, we often think of God's righteous judgments upon the wicked. But here we have rather a picture of the wicked judgments of the wicked. We see man's evil, corrupt judgment. We see Queen Mary the First, Bloody Mary, the daughter of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, calling for the burning at the stake by fire in the public square in the sight of men. 300 people who had led the new church away from the dictates of the Pope. That brings us to the third and last division of Revelation 13, verses 14 to 18, which foretell the rise of the Protestant Federation, symbolized by the image of the first beast. Let's first read just one verse, Revelation 13, 14. And deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image of, to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. So what is this new thing, this new beast, an image of the first beast? And again, it's shown rather small in that picture on the screen, if you can see it, just to the right of that green arrow. Let's analyze verse 14 closely. It begins by saying that the two-horned beast, that's the one we're still talking about in the context, the two-horned beast deceived the people by performing miracles in the sight of the first beast. What were the miracles of the two-horned beast performed, and what does in the sight of the beast mean? Well, in Brother Stunbaum's paper that I mentioned earlier, and in Brother Russell's writings on reprint page 321, they suggest that the miracles and wonders the two-horned beast, the church-state system of England and Ireland performed, was to set itself up as a copy of the church-state system of papal Rome, making deceitful decrees and pronouncements, persecuting heretics, and so on, just like the Roman Catholic Church had done. And the church-state system of England and Ireland did this not secretly or quietly, but in the sight of, in the full view of the papal church-state system, and miraculously, they got away with it. The papal beast, wounded by the Reformation, could not bring its full strength to bear against Henry VIII and later Elizabeth I and stop them from setting up their own church-state system, no longer under the authority of the Pope. That was unprecedented in world history, a wonder, a miracle in the eyes of man. Now, in the middle of verse 14, the prophecy jumps forward in time about 300 years to the year 1846. The two-horned beast deceives them that dwell on the earth, saying, make an image of the beast. What does this mean? How is this fulfilled? Brother Russell's explanation of this part of verse 14 in the foreword to volume 4 is excellent. The question now arises, why should the scriptures picture Protestantism as an image of the beast? When and how did this come about? From the time of the Reformation, Protestants had been striving individually to get out of the darkness of the past and it thus formulated many creeds and it organized many denominations. But about the middle of the last century, the leaders began to see that if everyone continued to study the Bible individually, the time would come when each one of them would have an individual creed. To prevent what seemed to them a loss of power, they planned a union of Protestants in a system called the Evangelical Alliance. Continuing, the Evangelical Alliance, an organization of the different Protestant denominations, was formed in 1846 for the very purpose of doing in their own way the same thing that Catholicism would do in its own way. Seeing the great power that Roman Catholics would exercise because of a united system, Protestants said, "We are divided. We have no power. We will organize." Then and there, according to the scriptures, they made an image of the beast. End of quote. And history concurs. It records that in 1846, Christians from 10 countries, 800 representatives in all, met for the purpose of launching in their own words, which you can find on the website worldevangelicalalliance.com, a new thing in church history, a definite organization for the expression of unity amongst Christian individuals belonging to different churches. Oh, and the city where this historically and prophetically significant meeting took place was London, England, the seat of the two-horned beast. This new beast in Revelation 13 was a close image of the first beast in several important ways. One was its gradual formation. Recall how the first beast rose gradually from small beginnings out of the sea over a period of 300 or years or so before the dragon gave the beast its power, seat, and authority in 539 AD. Likewise, this image had a small beginning in 1846. Only 800 representatives from 10 countries, but it has been growing ever since. Here are some milestones in the history of the growth and development of the Evangelical Alliance and also of church union in general. In 1908, the Federal Council of Churches in America was formed. In 1943, the National Association of Evangelicals was created. In 1944, the American Council of Christian Churches came into existence. And in 1950, the National Council of the Churches of Christ in the USA. Outside the USA on the international scene, we have seen, in 1910, the International Missionary Conference in Stockholm, which led to the 1925 World Conference on Life and Work and the 1927 World Conference on Faith and Order. Both conferences met again in 1937 and called for the creation of a new organization, and in 1948, the World Council of Churches emerged. And let's not forget even the Catholic Church's approaches to this coming together. The Second Vatican Council, held intermittently from 1962 to 1965, at which Protestant observers were invited. Lastly, on the website of the Evangelical Alliance is an announcement of an opening of an office in Brussels just last year, 2005, near the headquarters of the European Union to foster closer ties between church and state. So this image of the beast has been slowly, gradually fashioned and is now nearly complete. But there is one more momentous event foretold in Revelation 13. Let's read the end of the prophecy. Revelation 13, verses 15 to 18. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. This, of course, is the controversial part of this chapter. It describes the rise to heavy-handed power of this image of the beast after it is given life by the two-horned beast. So again, what does this mean? When does this apply? In the 1912 foreword to Volume 4, we read, "The Bible says, however, that before the image can do any particular harm, it must receive life from the two-horned beast. Although the Evangelical Alliance was organized in 1846, it has not been able to accomplish its purpose, because it did not know how to operate. The denominations in the alliance were united only in name, and hence have worked against each other. As a result, the image had no power to act. It was trodden upon, And to get vitality, life, it would need apostolic succession. It must have something as a basis for operation. The scriptures indicate that the Church of England will become intimate with the Evangelical Alliance. It will give it apostolic authority to preach. Because of this union, the Alliance will be able to say, we have apostolic authority to preach. That was written in 1912. A year later, in November of 1913, Brother Russell wrote this on reprint page 5349. The vitality of the image is to come from the two-horned beast, that is, the Church of England. We have been waiting for this consummation more than 30 years, and we have seen it draw nearer and nearer. A few years ago, the Episcopal Church took an important step toward vitalizing the Church Federation movement, which it is favoring and backing. That important step was the recognition of the ministers of the denominations represented in the Evangelical Alliance. Previously, no minister not ordained by the laying on of hands of a Catholic or an Episcopalian bishop was allowed to preach from an Episcopalian pulpit. And again, Episcopalian is the same as the Church of England. Perhaps this recognition of the image is all the vitalization the image needs. But we are inclined to expect more. Remember those words. We are inclined to expect more. For years, the Episcopalians have proffered reordination to the ministers of the different denominations represented in the Evangelical Alliance, and they still proffer it. We have been inclined to expect that the ministers would finally concede the point and accept reordination at the hands of an Episcopal bishop. Brother Russell waited more than 30 years to see that happen, and he never did. But brethren, the Lord has permitted us to see what he did not permit Brother Russell to see. Were you watching on August 19th, 1999, when a church-wide assembly of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, meeting in Denver, adopted an agreement of full communion? An excerpt is on the screen. I won't take time to read it, but the highlights of this one short paragraph that I excerpted from the longer document provides that beginning on January 1st, 2001, all newly consecrated Lutheran bishops, including their next presiding bishops, that's the Lutheran equivalent of the Pope in America, would be ordained by the laying on of the hands of an Episcopal bishop. And so, in the year 2001, the church founded by Martin Luther came under the ordination authority of the church founded by Henry VIII, who had once labeled Luther himself a heretic. And we saw it happen. Quoting from reprint page 5349 one more time, what comes next? As we understand this chapter of Revelation, the image, as soon as vitalized, will very promptly use its influence, prestige, power in every way to punish in the name of the Lord those who, in any sense of the word, it shall consider to be its opponents. Speedily, none will be allowed to buy or sell in the spiritual marts, except those who have either the mark or the number of the beast or the image, either in the right hand of cooperation or in the forehead of public confession. There is a controversy over this passage of scripture is similar to the one we heard discussed last evening regarding Revelation 14 and 18 and the fall of Babylon. And the controversial question, of course, is the fulfillment of Revelation 13, 15 to 18 in the past, or is it still future? Many Bible students say it is yet future, and that is my view as well. Much has already happened, but paraphrasing Brother Russell, I am inclined to expect more. However, some diligent and knowledgeable brethren see the fulfillment of these verses in the past, during in large part Brother Russell's day and even extending to the time period of World War II in Europe. And indeed, some of our brethren who are with us today have witnessed and even personally experienced persecutions that we have never seen or could even imagine in our own country and in our own time. Well, I can't discuss the controversy in detail here. Time will tell whether or not persecutions upon the true church at the hands of a counterfeit church-state system, a vitalized image of the beast, are in our future. But whichever side of the controversy you choose to support after your studies, there is a trap to be avoided. Let us not fall into the trap of living only in the future, focusing our attention on what persecutions we expect to come, and emotionally preparing ourselves so that we will be ready to endure that great test of our faith and loyalty without flinching. Because if we think only of withstanding tomorrow's anticipated trials and persecutions, we may well overlook smaller opportunities for sacrifice today. It is in the daily little things of our consecration that we will make our calling and election sure. So let us live not in the future, spending all our time today preparing for it. On the other side of the controversy, let us not spend all our time in the past, living only in the past and thinking that the work is all done, believing that there is nothing left for us to do in the Lord's wheat field, that all we can do now is sit and wait for our glorification and the establishment of the kingdom. Don't live your consecration only in the past, and don't live your consecration only in the future. Live in the present. To paraphrase a familiar quotation attributed to Eleanor Roosevelt, yesterday is history, tomorrow is a mystery. All we have is today, and it's a gift from God. That's why we call it the present. Let me close with these thoughts and a few final questions. The study of Revelation 13 is mostly a mental exercise, all head, no heart. We study to answer questions like, what do those symbols mean? When is their fulfillment? And sometimes the study of Revelation can seem like, dare I say it, sterile intellectualism, to borrow a phrase from one of my fellow Chicago elders. So I'd like to suggest this important lesson for our hearts in all of this detailed prophecy and history we reviewed today in Revelation 13. And it's found in verse 17 where it says that no man could buy or sell in the marketplace of religious ideas, meaning trading in the knowledge of God, witnessing to his character and plan, unless they had the mark of the beast or the number of his name. And our conventional Bible student interpretation of this text is that at some future date, everyone will be required to profess allegiance to the nominal church systems or face persecution. But bringing the lesson of this mark home to us today, I'd like to suggest this. Those who have the characteristics of the beast have his mark even today. It's not something only for the future. It has an application I'd like to suggest today. So what are the characteristics of the vast number of nominal Christian supporters of the beast? And we used that term yesterday in our discussion last evening as well. Here are a few of those marks I'd like to suggest. In the forehead, a lack of interest in personally studying the Bible to come to an understanding of it. Instead of personal study, there is an uncritical acceptance of the creeds of the denomination. The mark in the right hand, a lack of commitment to attend church services, or else a willingness to attend merely for the social interaction rather than for spiritual uplift and edification. Also, the mark in the hand indicates no spirit of sacrifice. There's nothing there. Instead, a Christian life when it's convenient and doesn't interfere with satisfying self. And there are more examples of these marks or characteristics that we lump together with that term, nominal Christian. A Christian in name only. Now, beneath all the symbols in Revelation 13, we have this strong underlying message for our hearts, a warning to us, the true followers of Christ, to avoid having the qualities that God hates in those who claim to be his children, but are not. By contrast, the true followers of Christ have these marks or characteristics, the seal of his Holy Spirit and his Father's name written in their foreheads. They and the picture of the tabernacle priesthood have the blood of sacrifice on their right ear, right hand, and right foot, showing zealous activity in service, doing with our might what our hands find to do and keeping our feet in paths of righteousness. So here are my final questions. Is it possible for us, brethren, to become nominal Bible students? Is it possible for us to have a mark of lack of interest in personal study, a mark of lack of active support of our ecclesia and its activities? What then is that mark on your forehead and in your right hand? Is it faint and barely legible, or is it clearly and boldly drawn for all to see? There's an expression in the world. It's as plain as the nose on your face, because the nose is the most prominent facial feature. May we strive to live our lives so that our consecrations are plainly visible to all with whom we come in contact. May we live so that our consecrations are as plain as the mark our Father's name written on our foreheads.